Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. If you're anything like me, you've been experiencing a feeling of loss of your sense of oneself as a free agent with control over her destiny. Over the next few weeks, I'll be rolling out a series of live webinars designed to give you back that important thing psychologists call locus of control or agency. The title of the series is Functional Medicine and the Immune System: What You Can Do to Help Yourself in the Age of COVID. I'm offering this course to all of my patients, but I also wanted to give my radio and podcast listeners an opportunity to participate as well. All you need to do is go to askdrdawn.com, click the Contact Us button, and then fill in your contact information and put functional medicine and the immune system in the subject line. You'll be sent information about the substance of the course and an overview and information about how to enroll, and I hope you'll choose to do so. For now, I'm going to take that piece of paper and give you just a little bit of an overview to today's adventure into the new normal, or maybe we should call it the new abnormal. We'll start off with a local update. I have some additional information about our situation here in Santa Cruz County, and I wanted to take some time and go through Governor Newsom's six-point plan. I know that other governors in Oregon and Washington, as well as on the East Coast, are doing something similar. I watch the nightly news as well, and they're thinking ahead. They're planning. They're trying to figure out how to do things in a stepwise and orderly fashion that keeps us all safe. And I think it's worth taking a little time to go over the plan, and I've got some highlights for you. After that, we're going to talk about fascinating bats and why they are like a boot camp for viruses, including coronaviruses, and we'll get some emails. Then I'm going to move to a discussion of existing devices and security apps and kind of do an overview of what's being done all over the world to try to figure out how we're going to loosen the shelter in place without causing another major surge. And how we're going to do that and how it's being done across the world is a fascinating story. So let's move now to the information that we had at the county health officer's presentation. And I attend two of these, one in my capacity as an administrator for the county medical society, and one in my capacity as a healthcare practitioner. And the practitioner meeting today was a lot of good information. I'm going to share some of it with you. Let's start with the fact that our doubling time is working out to about 8 days. That's good. It's a little lower here locally, but that's statewide. We've done so far 2,500 tests in Santa Cruz County, and we've had 91 positives. We had a second death. That gentleman was a bus driver up at UCSC, and I want to take my hat off to all of the people who handle our transport, who handle our food. The healthcare providers are getting a lot of singing and applause, and God knows they deserve every bit of it. But we also have to look at those people who are keeping us fed and safe and give them a shout out as well. We're going to talk about accuracy of the current nasal swab, which is a probe for three different bits of RNA that are part of the virus. And it's about, you've heard that 30% false negative rate. It's about 70% accurate taking all comers. The new tests that are out are about 97% accurate, which starts to be better when you're looking at someone who's
asymptomatic or who has a...
I think the people that are really throwing off the our information are the people who don't have COVID but do have symptoms. So in a Los Angeles study that just came out, 5% of people with mild flu-like illness were positive. These were people who presented for testing. In another study also out yesterday, 11%. And in China, a recent study looking at a very large screening test, it's about 5% of people with symptoms are positive. Now, you probably caught the serology study. This happened over the weekend. I guess, actually, it was back in March that the FDA put out an announcement, and they said, hey, labs, any independent lab that wants to try to come up with an immunoglobulin study, go for it, and we aren't going to come down on you. You can go ahead and make that and sell it. So we've got about five choices now for unproven immunoglobulin testing. There is a place called ArcPoint down in Monterey that was doing drive-through testing, and they've pulled back on that. I think they just got flooded with the tests and probably are very badly backlogged. There's one validated immunoglobulin test called Celex, but neither I nor the people at the Public Health Department could figure out how to order it. It does have published false positive and false negative, and that's where that 97% accuracy is coming from. The next thing I want to mention to you is that the antibody studies, including the one that Stanford is doing, and this is a subtlety, so listen carefully, I guess. I'm going to give you a metaphor, too. What Stanford is doing is a serology survey. They're going out and they're looking at antibody in the population to try to figure out how many people are already immune. But there's a problem here, and this is true of the commercial lab testing as well. This is antibody that will light up because it's attacking COVID, but it isn't necessarily neutralizing antibody. In other words, it may not be that protective, and perhaps that accounts for some of these questions about whether or not people actually get immune. So what's neutralizing antibody? Well, I'm going to have you visualize your TV remote, something you've probably been holding on to a lot in the last few weeks and can visualize perfectly well. And I want you to imagine that you took a gob of glue, and the glue is the antibody. And this is fluorescent glue, so you'll be able to see it in the dark. And so if your remote has a glob of fluorescent glue on it, you can find it to turn off the TV at 2 in the morning when you fall asleep. But that's antibody. That's how this antibody test is. It's just a gob of fluorescent glue. So it tells you where it is, but it tells you that you have the antibody because you can see the fluorescence. Now, if I take that fluorescent glue and instead of just putting it on the back of the remote, I put it on the on-off switch, that's neutralizing antibody. Now, the virus or the remote, either one, can't function, and that's what we want. We want to be making neutralizing antibody, but we aren't at this point actually testing for it. One of our big challenges, obviously, is going to be the skilled nursing facilities, and I'll just tell you that the public health people are going into all the skilled nursing facilities right now and trying to help them make a plan so that when people start to leave the hospital, the skilled nursing facilities will be able to isolate them and keep everyone else in the facility safe. That's something that we haven't had. There have been a few rather disastrous spreads through nursing homes, and we're just determined not to let that happen in our community. We're going to go to our first email, this one from Sharon in Aptos. Plasma antibodies, pros and cons. Hi, Dr. Don. I'd like your take on the potential value of using plasma antibodies as a bridge over while awaiting the development and proper vetting of an immunization, which, given the proper timing, could be years away. How do you see this working in our bodies? Might it teach our systems to produce effective antibodies, enough to see us recover as opposed to becoming respirator dependent? Might it confer seniors enough protection so that we can be free of social isolation without fear of ending up in an ICU and losing our lives or being disabled by chronic lung insufficiency thereafter, if fortunate enough to recover from a cytokine storm in the lungs? Thank you for filling a void in society that is obviously appreciated by many of us and providing guidance based on your eclectic educational background. Thank you, Sharon, for a very good question. And so I'm going to just take a moment to explain very briefly vaccination, which is a concept where you show a little bit of whatever entity you're trying to vaccinate against to the people, not an infectious dose, just enough to get the immune system familiar with it. Last week, we talked about the innate immune system and how that recognizes viral infections, but is nonspecific and does a lot of damage in the process. Whereas the acquired immunity, which is what we're talking about now with the vaccination, is an education process. You have to educate the immune system, rather like learning to ride a horse. They don't put you on the bucking bronco, you know, they put you on old paint and you learn to ride a easy horse. Well, you can think of the vaccine as a easy horse to get your immune system familiar with this entity, not get bucked off and not let you get sick. Then the next time, after building some skill, the immune system is able to ramp up. Jenner did the first vaccine a long time ago, back when smallpox was a huge disease, just very lethal. And cowpox, a cow-related virus that milkmaids would get, made them immune to smallpox. He got the bright idea of basically opening up the pimples, the pox, so to speak, which is what those were. They looked like pimples, big boils, and taking some of the pus and poking it into somebody else. And that would give them a little dose of this milkmaid disease. They'd get sick, but after that, they'd be immune to smallpox. And it worked. Pasteur, who's one of my personal heroes, went after rabies. And rabies was another horrible scourge. They infected rabbits with rabies on purpose. And then when the rabbits died, they took their nerves, because rabies is a virus that lives in nerves, and they set them out basically and dried them out for 10 to 15 days and then powdered them and injected them, and it worked. So the Pasteur-Roux vaccine was the first attenuated direct viral vaccine. In other words, too much of that, if you didn't weaken it, could actually give someone rabies. And most of our vaccines now, since we no longer give the smallpox vaccine, are in fact either fragments or, in the case of quote-unquote live vaccine, highly weakened versions of the target organism. So when we talk about plasma, we're talking about essentially leveraging someone else's antibody production. And unfortunately, the only antibodies that your body is likely to make would be antibodies against the stem of that person's antibodies, fortunately. So there's a small risk of actually becoming allergic to that person's antibodies, which means with repeated exposure, you could theoretically actually get a reaction that we call serum sickness from it. Now that comes from the old days when we used to give the disease to horses and then take their blood and pull off their plasma and use that to treat disease. Now, the use of human plasma from people who have recovered from illnesses goes back many, many decades. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was first done in the 1930s. Ebola, well, it was used, and it's been used in just about every movie about an epidemic, and it is a practical way to help boost the immunity because it takes virus out of action. So when, to the extent that you attach the immunoglobulins from a plasma injection to the virus particles or the bacterial particles that would be floating around in the bloodstream or floating around in the system, then they're going to get glommed onto just like that glue on the remote, except these are neutralizing antibodies and will prevent the virus from spreading to other tissues. So you reduce the spread of the virus and the amplification of it. I do not know at what stage that's going to prove to be the best. I would think well before people get very sick and well before they sustain severe damage to their lungs. So the time to do that may turn out to be early in mild to moderate COVID-positive patients, because it might alter the natural history of the disease. It's not something that is particularly common right now, and I'm not sure that it will ever be safe to give this as a early preventative to allow people more freedom of movement. It may need, certainly will be needed to be preserved for that right pivotal moment along the clinical course of people who become more severely ill. I'm just going to reach out to Howard and say, Howard, do we have someone we want to put on the air?
Yes, we do. Paul, are you there? Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. Tell me your name and where you're calling from.
Yeah, Jay from Santa Cruz.
Jay from Santa Cruz. Hey, Jay. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I'm just curious, since all the stores are out of hand sanitizer, and I was wondering if mouthwash would be an acceptable substitute for hand sanitizer.
Unfortunately, no. Mouthwash is only, I think it's 17% alcohol, and you need 70% alcohol.
That was my question. I was curious about that because I want to use hand sanitizer and it's not available. So I thought, well, maybe a substitute for that.
No, that won't work. Soap is good. And so if you're out of hand sanitizer, what you got is two bottles. And one of the bottles has clean water in it. And the other one has either some liquid or some solid soap. You could also get like a little knife and slice off some soap flakes and put them in a baggie. This bug does not like soap. Soap basically will melt the virus. And it literally is melting, though. And as you know, melting takes a little bit of time. So you need to do that whole 20-second by-the-clock hand wash. So you get your hands a little bit wet. You put your soap flakes on there. You scrub, scrub, scrub. And then you take your clean water bottle and you rinse off and you dry your hands on a regular towel and you're good.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's very helpful. I really appreciate that information. And I'll put it into practice.
Jay, if you can find 70% alcohol, that's 140 proof, however. And rubbing alcohol, of course, is still available in a lot of places, and you can try for that. And I had hoped that we would be seeing some local homegrown rubbing alcohol from, or some very hyper-concentrated ethyl alcohol from the local distilleries, because if you took whiskey and you just ran it through the still a little longer, you could get 70% alcohol. I'm not sure you'd be legal to sell it, though. I don't know what the regulations are.
Could you use vodka as a hand sanitizer?
Not strong enough. Vodka is 100 proof, which means it's 50%.
Oh, 100 proof.
Okay. Yeah. So if you can figure out how to set up a still and not blow yourself up, you might be able to do it. But soap and water. Soap and water,
cool.
Cheap, widely available. Decent. We're all going to be reduced to carrying around, to washing our hands in the parking lot.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So I have a recommendation, actually, for a game and an entertainment for people with young children, and it also serves to build healthy eating habits. And what everyone does, what you do is you set up a rainbow. That's purple, blue, green, yellow, orange, and red. Those are the five colors for this particular rainbow. And you could do it on a bulletin board. You could print them out, but each person has to make an X when they eat something that's naturally got that color. So when you eat an orange, you make an X in orange. And when you eat a cherry, you make an X in red. Apples do count as red or green, by the way, in case you're wondering. And the concept is to try and eat a rainbow, to make sure that you get an X in each box every day. And kids really respond to that, and they start getting creative, and they start exploring other orange foods, for example, or other red foods, which can be a great blessing when you're stuck giving young children unfamiliar food to eat and still trying to keep them healthy. So, just a thought. Let's change topics now, but it's very germane because it's all about the immune system and that innate immunity that is part of what can lead to a cytokine storm. There's different flavors of cytokine storm, and everyone's now thinks they know what it is, but it's really different depending on the characteristics of the disease. And if one goes back and reads contemporary accounts of the 1918 flu, and I highly recommend a book by a man named John Barry called The Great Flu. I interviewed him a decade ago when that book came out, and it's an excellent discussion of the flavor of 1918 cytokine storm that occurred. When the immune system gets very sick, the immune system sends out all kinds of alarms. It's a five-alarm fire, and those alarms create a cascade that is so highly inflammatory that it causes tissue damage. And we think that's what's happening in this sort of secondary dip that puts people in the ICU and sometimes puts them on ventilators, and then causes their lungs to fill with fluid as if they had been through a major trauma and hemorrhage. Because that's what it looks like. It looks like shock lung. Here's where the bats come in. This is an article I have from Le Monde, which is a French newspaper, and so I'll have to be a little bit hesitant from time to time. They talk in this article a lot about how the coronaviruses are found in bats. The coronavirus, COVID-2, is closest to a virus that's found in bats. About 96% common with that. We're 97, I believe, with the chimpanzees. So that's pretty darn close. And according to an analysis by Dr. Boney of the University of State University of Pennsylvania, Penn State, the viruses split about roughly 20 to 40 years ago. And during that time, we presume that SARS-CoV-19, whatever you want to call it, SARS-CoV-2, was wandering around in bats. And indeed, bats have very high levels of virus, very high frequencies of being infected with SARS viruses in general. There was a study published a couple of years ago, and it was just looking for coronavirus in animals, not this coronavirus particularly, but just that category of virus. So they tested 12,000 bats, and 1,000 were positive. They checked 3,500 primates, and 4 were positive, 3,000 rats, and 11 positive in 3,000 rats, and 2 in 1,000 humans. So this is all coronaviruses, including cold viruses. The coronaviruses have a natural reservoir in bats. And here's the other thing. Bats don't get sick. Bats are very, very resilient. And we don't entirely understand why. But what we think happens is that these coronaviruses mutate, and we'll come back to that, in bats, and then move to an intermediate mammalian host. And you've heard about the pangolin, and that's probably how it got into the market in Wuhan. So for SARS, it's the civet, which is a kind of cat, it's the camel for MERS, it's Ebola, it's monkeys, a virus called Nipah that happened in Malaysia, it was pigs, and of course we all remember swine flu. You get the point. These viruses migrate into a mammal, they mutate some more, and then they get the ability to migrate into humans. But so what's going on with the bats? Why don't they get sick? How can they wander around with these viruses and not be made ill by them? First of all, there's a lot of bats out there. I had no idea when I read this article. There are 1,300 different species, and that represents 25% of the named mammals, which is just such a surprise. And bats are very, very interesting creatures. They have an amazing innate immune system. Aside from rabies, there's actually no virus that kills bats or that's known to kill bats. And bats don't get, and this is so very important for us, bats don't get the cytokine storm. And given how strong their immune system is, you would expect that that would happen. Bats live up to 40 years. There's one 7-gram bat that's been shown to live 40 years. This is really weird for small mammals. Small mammals don't live a long time. The 40-year-old bat makes me think of Mr. Jangles in The Green Mile. They also don't get cancer. And here's one. Their telomeres don't get short. All other mammals, when their cells divide, their telomeres get shorter. That doesn't happen. They also have a really, really good DNA repair mechanism. How come the bats have got all this good stuff? Well, part of it has to do with their immune system. They've got a really strong immune reaction, but they've also got a very strong anti-inflammatory reaction. It's balanced, in other words. So they have high levels of the good interleukins that are calming down the immune system, like IL-10, 11, 13. And their immune system doesn't deteriorate. Unlike every other mammal, their immune system doesn't deteriorate with age. And the reason they've got this is it's all about flying. Okay, bats fly. When they fly, they need to produce prodigious amounts of ATP very rapidly. Compared with resting, when a bat flies, its metabolic rate goes up 15 times. Now, when a human goes from resting to sprinting at top speed, their metabolic rate goes up 3 times. That's the most that we can manage. And along with that metabolic rate, you've got a huge, huge load of oxidative stress. So much oxidative stress. You know, we take antioxidants to help our bodies deal with oxidative stress. Well, that would kill the DNA, all that oxidative stress. So the DNA has great repair mechanisms. And the ability to be anti-inflamed is also good, and that donates, that contributes to the long life of these animals. So they're great at fighting disease, which is awesome. And they're incredibly powerful in terms of their immune system. And this creates an evolutionary challenge for any bat, right? For any bat coronavirus. If the virus, basically, it's like the bat is its personal trainer. And if that virus is going to get anywhere, it has to get really powerful, really strong, just to survive the onslaught of that immune system. So it gets clever and it mutates. And they have to work really hard just to hang on. Then they mutate, they try something else. Well, let's change this receptor or see what that does. And lo and behold, I mean, it's not deliberate, it's accidental, but that's how viruses drift genetically. And then they can get into a pangolin or they can get into a camel. And then once they're in a mammal, they can get into a person. Last week I called coronavirus Gaia's immune system, but I think it's better to call it Newtonian Darwinism. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Well, for every mutation, there's a counter mutation. And to the extent that we just left bats and wild animals in their natural habitat and didn't, you know, tear down the jungle and build a condo, we would not be exposed to these viruses. But particularly as we have a trade in exotic animals, that's crazy. I mean, you know, the thing about the tiger in the Bronx Zoo, where, well, my head went to, I wonder if the Tiger King could be infected. But here we are, folks. We need to think about how our actions in the environment, both global warming but also habitat destruction, are going to recoil on us in an equal and opposite reaction and endanger our health. Besides just getting smarter, maybe we need to get a little bit nicer to the planet and the other inhabitants on it. So let me see. I think we might have a caller. Looks like Chris is on line two. Hello, are you Chris?
I am Chris.
Hello, Chris. Welcome. And what would you like to talk about?
Two things. First of all, listening to the amazing little discussion you just made, a monologue, but on the bat, it kind of made me think, God, I never thought I'd really want to wish I were a bat, but now I kind of do.
No, huh? Maybe that's where the vampire bat and Dracula and the immortality.
Batman age, right?
Well, he doesn't seem to. But the franchise is aging rapidly, if you ask me.
Around for Marvel comics. Now, hey, listen, I'm the host of Classical Tune-Up, just in case you didn't know. But anyway, I've called a few times before. I might ask questions for my wife. But actually, I was wondering, this is slightly off topic, so it's raising them to a different level, but maybe you can comment on this. And you could. I just heard it. I was flabbergasted. It's a political question, so if you can dally with that for a moment. That the president just said he's defunding the World Health Organization. I'm just wondering, from your perspective as a medical professional and knowing, you know, how these pandemics work and what the effort is internationally to make this happen, I've heard someone, I don't know, this was from the United Nations or something, saying, you know, this is tantamount to a crime against humanity, basically, that he's sentencing people to death. And I'm just wondering, you know, is this hyperbole or... Yeah, to what extent can you maybe comment on that? I'm just kind of curious because, you know, obviously we all have to deal, like you just said, everyone, we all have to deal with this all over the world.
Well, you know, when your 8-year-old has a tantrum and they scream, "I hate you, I wish you were dead," you kind of take a deep breath and you say, probably they're going to feel differently in the morning. And I think we've seen enough of that flip-flopping, I believe, that we probably are not going to see the World Health Organization defunded at a time when we need international cooperation more than ever. I believe that the functional adults in the room, and there still are a few, will probably make the "you do this, you own the whole damn thing" argument, and that is not how our fearless leader wants to go down in history. So I don't take it seriously. I really don't. And I think it'll get backed away over the next few days because it's a terrible idea. It's an incredibly terrible idea, especially at this moment. And I just don't think it'll happen.
Okay, well, that's reassuring. But because I do think of how you know, America's been always considered the leader in the world, right? The leader who just said, this is how we get things done internationally. And it's like we're advocating that. If this is true, I'm thinking, my God, what are we if we're not helping the world, you know, manage these major crises, you know?
Well, I guess we know who wants to step into that role. I don't think it's necessarily a great idea. But, hey, let's get back to your health question, okay?
That was actually my point. I was just more like, I was wondering what you thought of that. That was my
question. Yeah. Well, basically, I don't think it'll happen. I think international cooperation is much too important, and the World Health Organization, it's one of the organizing entities. Like, for example, in our local community, I'm very proud that the County Medical Society has been able to do things like obtain and distribute expired N95 masks to independent physicians who weren't part of the food chain.
Right.
But what made that work was the fact that they have a staff and they have the best mailing list, and so we could reach people. And so having the role, what, you know, I'm going to date myself, but having the Rolodex or having the 5,000 contacts in your phone, that's the person that you want on the ground coordinating. And I'd like that to be the United States because we've built relationships and trust for a very, very long time. And we're in the process of burning those up for no good reason. I'm going to ask you a question, not to put you on the spot, But have you been using any of the delivery apps lately? And I would ask that to just the audience at large. But, you know, like the Uber Eats and Grubhub and things like that. I've been seeing a lot of people who appear to be making a living traveling around, picking stuff up and taking it and dropping it off.
I know exactly what you're saying, yeah.
But, you know, so it was a rhetorical question, but what are your thoughts on that issue, if you have any?
You mean like to use the app to have people bring food to you or something like Grubhub?
I'm just wondering if you're doing it very much, you personally. I don't really know.
My habits, and I live in Santa Cruz, downtown Santa Cruz, so easy enough to walk downtown to do the takeouts, and I support the local businesses that I
Thank
can.
Thank you.
And we just did tonight, actually. The taqueria downtown. We went and picked up my wife and I picked up some tacos. Jackie says hello to you, by the way. We haven't used it ourselves because we're in close proximity to places we like and can support, you know. But if you're up in Boulder Creek or something, maybe you got to do that. Yeah.
Well, hopefully you take advantage of some of the great stuff on online. But this, what I wanted to do. Thanks, Chris, very much for your call.
Thank you for your time. Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye. What I wanted to do was I wanted to take a moment and pivot to the fact that you're not really helping the restaurants. You're getting your food. But Uber Eats, for example, charges a 25% commission on orders with restaurants. Grubhub has some kind of deal, charges a commission on the full price of the meal, even though they are promoting this $10 discount. That discount doesn't come out of their hide, it comes out of the restaurant. So a lot of people, a lot of restaurants are earning very, very little, even though they're not really making anything like the kind of money they used to make. And the delivery apps, this guy says he used to make $5,000 in business on a typical night. And recently he earned $600 through delivery apps, and their commission added up to $131, which basically didn't cover much, including, you know, the cost of the food. So in a way, these delivery entities, although it's a very Faustian bargain, and we have to, I would say, pressure the companies to reduce their commissions because they're profiteering on a crisis right now. And I think we need to threaten. I know not everybody can do this, but I think if you do them and you can tell them you're going to stop because you found out they are charging outrageous commissions on restaurants that are basically on the rope and trying to feed us and stay in business, that they need to reduce that, I think that would make a very big difference. So those of you who are social media mavens out there, please take some steps because that's wrong. Let's go to the next topic that I announced that we were going to cover. And that has to do with getting out of this. So let me see. I'm going to pop over here. And I don't know how many of you caught Gavin Newsom's excellent press conference. I had a chance to review the transcripts. I love that about the internet because I read far faster than I listen. And he announced a framework to guide decision-making on how we ease up on it. And he talked about what that second phase needs to look like and how we can get there. So there are six things. And the first of these is expanding testing. That's already happening. We have a rapid test at Dominican that's going online. It'll be limited not by speed but just by the availability of reagents. Emmeline has a test that can do 50 tests a week. The Watsonville Community Hospital has the ID Now, which is a 15-minute turnaround time. So it's one test at a time, so you can figure out what's 24 hours times 15 minutes, assuming they can get the reagents. But other tests are coming, and a quick test is key before we can open up things. We also need to look at, according to Newsom, we need to look at what other countries are doing to protect their seniors and the specific strategies that we need here in California because of our homelessness problem are, you know, quite unique. He also talked a lot about making sure that we are well prepared for another surge, but that we have protective gear for example, bus drivers, that we need to be able to protect everyone in the hospital. And he talked about how we are so very lucky to have partners doing research. We're very advanced, and there's a lot of technology here in California that puts us in an important place. As we think forward, another thing which had not occurred to me, it makes complete sense, is that we're going to need to change our floor plans, at least for the next couple of years. When a restaurant opens up, it's going to have fewer tables. They're going to be further apart. We're going to have to continue to keep our social distancing, especially if you're going to be eating, because we may have to develop special strategies. I was thinking about, back in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, people carried around their old fork and knife because they couldn't expect to have those available wherever they went. I wonder if we find ourselves, you know, carrying our own cutlery or using disposable cutlery in order to be sure that we're in a safe space. It's very important for us to think about how we're going to do school. Are we going to do away with lunch and recess and just have the kids for 4 hours and do intense things and maybe have two shifts of 4 hours? Or maybe even three? Or how can we do social distancing and get our society back? Is school going to be half at home and half at work? And how, if it is half at home, do we provide for the people who have to work outside of the home, particularly low-income people? And I'm pleased to say that it really does look like they are making a plan that has a good chance of working. With that being said, one of the things we have done really poorly in California, and it's national, we've all done poorly with it, and that's having the ability to do contact tracing. In countries like South Korea and Singapore, they were able, for a lot of reasons, to do contact tracing. So as cases were identified, they did what we do with venereal disease. That's what contact tracing is. If you show up with gonorrhea, a nice person from the health department comes and says, I'd like the names of all of your sexual contacts, please. And then they go out and they contact those people. This is mandatory state reporting, by the way. If a doctor diagnoses you, you will get a call. And tell the truth, by the way, if we ever get to the point of contact tracing, tell the truth, because that person, if you're positive, they might be positive. And we need to find them and their child that's sleeping in the crib and the elder that's sleeping in the back room. We need to do contact tracing. So you need to be honest. And as we influence each other by our behavior, I just want to emphasize that this is a key piece to getting back to anything resembling on top of this bug. So how are we going to do that? How do you know who you were near? What about the guy who sat three things behind you on the bus? Was he too close? Maybe, you know, that 6-foot rule isn't perfect. So the question really becomes, do we do it with a device, like a leg band, house arrest kind of thing? There's a company that made a little dongle. Let's see. It's called Proof of Health. And it checks how many close interaction a person's had with coworkers. It's a Bluetooth device, and it uses passive GPS location tracking and proximity sensors. So when you get close enough to somebody else, that gets registered on the device and stored locally. And I'm not sure how, if someone you've been around turns positive, it works, but I can tell you how they're doing it in other countries. So in Hong Kong, they're using WhatsApp. And you basically, when you come into Hong Kong, if you're a person of interest, so to speak, you are told to put a certain phone number in your WhatsApp and fix the location sharing to always on, and then every 8 hours you have to reactivate it and turn it back on because of how the app is set up. Other countries are doing something different. South Korea has a customized app that sounds an alarm and alerts an official if people stray who are under quarantine. And in South Korea, as of March 21st, 42% of the 10,000 people under quarantine were using the app. Taiwan goes straight for the phone. They track the cell phones using people from data masks. If you're out of bounds on your quarantine, you're going to hear from them. In China, they have something called the Health Check app. It runs through portals in the payment apps Alipay and WeChat. Let's see, it's self-reported data about places visited and symptoms to generate a QR code that's displayed in green, orange, or red, corresponding to either free movement, 7-day, or 14-day quarantine. And people who are in the green are allowed to move around more freely, but don't lie to the Chinese government or you may find yourself getting re-educated. Now, Google Maps is on most of our phones, and those could be very useful. One of the things that one researcher at the University of Copenhagen is modeling is looking at interactions through cell phone data and trying to data source how do those interactions work. Like, for example, if you sat at a coffee shop for half an hour with a friend, how is that in terms of risk when one of them is positive compared to getting a package delivered by a positive person? We don't know that. We don't have any idea. But let's see, as of the middle of last month, about a month ago now, March 16th, the Israeli government's been using all sorts of tracking. The parliament initially limited the powers, but they basically took that limitation away once parliamentary oversight was concerned. So now, essentially, wherever you go in Israel, they know where you've been, they know who you've been near, and if anybody turns positive, they are going to be able to do really good contact tracing at a pretty high cost. So Singapore has got an app which can identify close-ish contacts of people who come down with COVID. It's called Trace Together. I actually like this one. When people are within 2 meters of each other, their phones get in touch via Bluetooth, and if they're close together for more than 30 minutes, both phones record this encounter and encrypt it on the device. When anyone with the app is diagnosed with the virus or identified as part of a cluster, they get a call from the health ministry telling them to empty their cache for the contact tracers, who then decrypt it and go find everybody else you were around for 30 minutes who were close enough to register. Because this could be people in a theater, people on a bus. And I like this app because it does protect privacy. If you're not exposed, your data is erased, and it's not everyone you were around. It has a time limit, which is legitimate in terms of this. And it doesn't collect geolocation data, but it does include proximity. So you could get geolocation down the line. So I actually think Singapore, as is often the case, has the best strategy here, and it would not surprise me at all, I hope, actually, that something like that, storing on the device and surrendering your information only when there's a benefit to you, which is to say putting you in quarantine and watching you and testing you, I think this is the kind of strategy that is balanced and, at least to the extent that it's possible, respects privacy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.